This is Tucker Madovic's interview, 10-22-87. This is side three, the Tucker.
Are we on? We are.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, I've done it.
No, let it go.
All right, before proceeding with the Tucker story, I'd like to go backwards in time for a moment. Back to Early Pratt Institute, 1935. The gentleman's name I was reaching for was Donald Dona, who was the first professor, head of the School of Design at Pratt Institute. He was the one who came up with the curriculum and was with us about 2 years before he left us, and that's where Alexander Costello came in. Donald came in from Carnegie Institute. He was a staff designer there and had good mechanical background and come up with this curriculum and the need for a school of design that would be dedicated to one thing, designing of items for mass production. And that's how it really all started.
Good.
Now, you want to just stop that button, or maybe we can just... getting back to Donald Dona, one of the main reasons for putting this new machine or this new school of design together was the challenge at Pratt was the contributions of the engineers going back over the past 100 years. It was an engineer who conceived the Model T Ford, which we're all envious of today. Locomotives, you can name some of the greatest machines produced by mankind, but they fail to answer the qualities of human engineering, the size of the person who would use them, maintain them. The noise level was never a concern, and as a young designer, were two things we were concerned with. Weight is the enemy, and of course, number two, noise is a very harmful, distracting thing, and if you could minimize noise and reduce weight, you had something going for you. But these and many more elements came out, and we were not eliminating the scope of the engineer, because he is licensed, he is trained to produce products that are structurally sound. We were concerned about the aesthetics and the environment that the individual who ran this machine would nest in or live in or sit in. And so even today, it's a combination of Mr. Inside, Mr. Outside, and whether you're doing electronics or steam turbines or anything else, aircraft, it's the where the pilot sits, where the people sit, and how they make these things. And Donald put it all together in the curriculum, and I still think it's basically his concept today.
Mm-hmm.
Now we'll move on to the Tucker. I believe we're chatting about two concepts here, the Lippincott model and the tremulous model. It's a shocker to a lot of people that haven't realized that, they were really three concepts, the Tucker torpedo.
Which was?
George Larson, ex-General Motors, and Briggs, and then of course the Alex Tremulous bit, and his concept of the Tucker, and then a hesitation by Preston Tucker to bring in an outside consulting group with really the same experience he's had. They had no experience in automotive design or fabrication. And we assume we're not welcomed by Alex, but before we knew it, we had a buck parallel to his, and like it or not, we had to have a togetherness, coexistence, as they say. And it wasn't difficult, because we both had a boss who was there night and day. It was easy to get a response from him, and we had no intentions of changing the concept. It was a matter of refinement and bringing some new nuances that we felt would be a step ahead of what the big three were doing. It was a challenge here. As I mentioned earlier, Studebaker was well underway, about to make its debut, and we knew that the big three were zooming in on some radical changes that were needed. It was a crash program. We worked 7 days a week. There was no problem. There were bonuses that were offered to all of us. As I told Dave earlier, we lived for a while at the Drake Hotel, a month or two, had business meetings there with the Preston staff on Friday afternoons, and didn't take them long to realize that we'd be better off down at the Southmore Hotel in Cicero, and that move was accomplished.
Which is where the old Dodge engine plant was.
Yes, correct. Yeah. That was correct. Yeah. And that cut us off from the excitement up there, and of course those wonderful dinners we had I'm trying to think of the room right now, but...
The Camellia Room?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
That was it. But these two units started to grow, and as I said, we had Phil Egan, we had Mattawick, we had Reed Viemeister, Bud Steinhilber.
And Viemeister?
V-I-E-M-E-I-S-T-E-R.
And the other one?
Bud Steinhilber, S-T-E-I-N-H-Helber. Steinhilber, H-E-L-B-E-R.
Helber or Hilbert?
Helber. I'm gonna have you Xerox this front piece in there, and it'll give you
good... Those are the types, yeah.
Yeah, good authenticity, you can do that.
Good.
But in
so,
the...
So you arrived on the scene, if I may, you arrived on the scene with a commission through Lippincott to come up with an alternative design?
Or, not necessarily.
Or to assist Alex in fine-tuning the two designs that had already been done?
We were retained to design the car, not knowing in New York City that the thing was beyond its embryo. This thing was already...
Didn't Tucker tell Lippincott that he already had Tremulous?
Not necessarily. No, he did not.
He didn't?
Did not. He did not. And when we got out there, there was this...
It wasn't quite a shock.
Oh, it was. It was growing. It was really growing. And
you were obviously the leader in terms of experience and...
That's correct.
You were the leader of the group, and when you went out there, you found Alex Tremulous already...
It was well-staffed, absolutely, and the buck was maturing. It had clay on it, and he was well along.
Uh-huh. And he had some sketches, of course.
He had sketches, and the Larson model was also there, which was a quarter-scale model of that torpedo.
Now, in lieu of no audio of visual material here, may I ask you this? Was Tremulous working from the torpedo? In other words, was he using that as a base of reference for his, or was his, obviously there was some base of reference there.
I really think the torpedo was an influence, Dave,
yeah.
Because the original sketches that we saw that Alex did, believe it or not, had center steering, had a cyclops eye, had cycled fenders, the driver sat forward of the two passengers,
right.
Which when you get right down, exciting concept, but I mean, very, very difficult in maneuvering and parking, etc. And the car had a lot of fast shapes and negative canted surfaces to it.
Uh-huh.
We remember those drawings. Remember the torpedo scale model was there because Preston had bought that or acquired it through George Larson.
Mm-hmm.
But we started out, there were many, many details. The front end, go ahead.
One quick question. Now, I'll let you go ahead. Was there any friction between your team and Tremulous?
I would say no. It may have been visible. That's correct. I mean, when you're a consultant, you accept this. It's bound to happen, and we knew that. We knew there'd be an abrasive attitudes there, that he had a direct line to engineering, we had a dotted line to engineering. We had to, in turn, clear everything through Alex's to clearances, because engineering had already given these tentative clearances.
Yeah.
But the mystique started to grow, because we had an engine that was running in the test lab. By the way, this was all in an area, I would say, for scale purposes, let's say 75-foot square. This was the administrative offices. This was the test bed for the flat six-cylinder post engine that ran night and day. Dynamometer in bed was short exhaust stacks. Remember that this was the factory. We had high ceilings and concrete floors. And
your vivid description, you were an enclave in one corner of a very large facility.
You could hear people walking towards this area. You could hear them for a half a mile, clippity clap, 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 coming. We knew somebody was coming. And then there was the infamous drop hammer that Herman Ringling, one of the top guys.
Tell us about
that. Oh, he was, well, he had built a lot of the racing cars for, he was an ex-Duesenberg and Cord man, who had, with a drop hammer, you know, and a sheet of metal or aluminum, by moving the hammer, hits the metal and moves the sheet to where you want it.
Okay.
If you want a subtle radius, you want to go convex, concave.
Was this a technique that was useful?
Oh, yes, because...
It was infamous.
Oh, well, no, and I didn't mean it that way, because in doing the doors and the hood,
uh-huh.
You could move metal so quickly.
Really?
Oh, you really would.
Herman Ringling?
Herman Ringling was
the
his name.
The drop hammer technique of metal...
Absolutely. Metallurgy, whatever you would call it, and just moving the metal. And what you would do is thin it out and move that metal elsewhere. And when you thin it out, you would start to get these crowns.
This was a sophisticated version of the old craftsmen who beat metal in
very
Jordan
similar.
Or somewhere.
Absolutely, very similar.
Okay.
Very similar. But he was a man who was working night and day. I mean, he was the Cellini, as I said yesterday. He was the Michelangelo of the Robham family. And that's the way they made one-of-a-kind racing cars, and the majority of the Dietrich, LeBaron, were all done really on a drop hammer.
Really?
They were all pounded over wood.
Of course.
Because you didn't have the big steel dies, male and female. It was the cost is prohibitive to do it. So,
this probably cut the time in half.
Oh, it really did. It really did, but if Herman died, it was moved elsewhere. Shut the plant.
Did he have a patent on it?
No, just
okay.
Pure experience.
That's fascinating.
But here again now, we knew the engine. Let me give you some of the disciplines here that were established. We knew it was going to be a rear engine. But we knew it was going to be air-cooled. And that just permitted us, we didn't realize that later on it would be liquid-cooled. We had to have radiators. We had to have, they were running test samples right then with the Armor Institute in Chicago, trying to come up with the appropriate diameter fan and shrouding, like a VW or Porsche, to get that air around the engine. And we had all these test units going on. We had no human factors or environmental buck where you could sit people in and go determine the entrance into the front seat or the back seat. You know, this thing was getting hard, and we were having Herman bang out sheet metal because the Tin Goose number one was really ready. That late spring, they had one sheet metal complete, but that was the one they showed with no reverse on it, or the engine wasn't even the appropriate engine. It had disc brakes, but they weren't the kind that would ultimately be found in, because we had a lot of these ifs and buts going on, and you'd no doubt get rid of something. The engineers would come in and say, gee, we can't get it in there. You change this, give me more room. I have to have access. The hood's got to be wider. And this went on and on and on, and so you got one man saying, I want it done tomorrow. And you had to be sympathetic to the engineers. I mean, these men were responsible for this thing.
And he hired some really good people, too.
Oh, good gosh. Yeah. He brought them forward from General Motors. But the more you realize the
tremendous
salaries and bonuses to be, franchises.
Huh?
It was DeLorean all over again. You know, DeLorean received $2 million from Johnny Carson for just the West Coast.
Sure.
There was money like that. There was good money coming in. But we had a lot of areas in the car that would stalemate you. You'd think you'd have it done on a weekend, you'd get approval, and then they would say, hey, you couldn't touch that area for a while. And we only had these $2. Then, of course, we said, why don't we move into a two-door or a convertible or a, you know, no, let's get this four-door out. Nobody ever said, what would another model look like? None of us ever anticipated what the 1950 model would look like. Now, any designer working for any corporation, you immediately build in the obsolescence of that model and how you would facelift the front, minor tooling, to give you a new look facially in the front, keep the old four doors, change the taillights in the back. We could never find time on his busy agenda to even talk about, what will the next car look like? The more you add this up, the more you say, I wonder whether he wanted to go beyond 50 cars. The assembly lines were unique. They were basically where you would bring up a chassis, you had the chassis on wheels, and then stuff was put on, just like putting product into a paper bag. There was no sophisticated overhead belts bringing the product in. Then you say, it's funny. Yes, we weren't looking at car number 2,000, car number 12,000. And then the tools were made all on Kirkside, which is used today. It's soft. It'll give you K-I-R-K-S-I-T-E, Kirkside.
Is that a tooling alloy?
It is. Basically, it had a high aluminum content in it. Quick to form and make, but you couldn't stamp with great rigidity. It would not take the impact the steel would, but you could press a suitable number of parts out on it. But
looking back at it, you seem to think that he wasn't looking beyond maybe 50 hand-built cars at that point.
Well, in the meetings, it was always something, look, the prospectus, everything that he sold to the dealership, and why a smart dealer, and a lot of them had been GM, Ford, and whatnot, they wanted to get in on this, and one would say, hey, you've got to go beyond that one car. Got to go beyond it. And you're going to run that one forever? You know, it wasn't the perfect answer to a car. He claimed all these mileage prerequisites and whatnot, 35 miles to the gallon, a car weighing 2,000 pounds, an engine weighing 300 pounds. You know, this is fairy tale. Absolutely.
He began to move, as it went on, it seemed though he began to move out of the out of realism into some kind of self-induced fantasy.
That's a
hypnosis, really.
It had to have been something that we were not cognizant of, because that part of the dream, like the money, whatever happened to the $28 million? Nobody seemed, I don't know whether he dug a hole, we don't know. But it took the SEC about 10, 12 months to review the papers and whatnot. And when they said shut the plant down, he had 37 cars complete. The other 14, this is all in the book.
Yeah.
We give you all the specifics.
Well, we wouldn't have it for this, so give us some.
No. And believe it or not, 37 complete, and 14, that would give you what, 17 and 37 and 14 is 51.
Mm-hmm. Which is just about the amount that.
That was it.
They were built.
And the way filled out.
Excuse me, were the 37 on the premises? Still?
37 on the premises, right. None were shipped out at all. None were shipped out to any of the dealers and whatnot. But yet, in inventory at that time, were just enough parts for 50 cars, or 51 cars. That is interesting. Now, here again, did he try, because we know we had a purchasing group. We know that. Every major corporation would have a purchasing group, a sourcing group.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we assume these people tried to go out, and possibly in dealing with Briggs & Murray and Kelsey Hayes Wheels and all the people.
Mm-hmm.
You had to compete against the big three. They came first.
Right.
Then Willys came next, and some of the other small ones, Nash,
right,
were around then. But somebody must have known. But we were so busy doing our thing,
of course,
and getting paid for it and having a lot of fun, and you weren't worrying about what's going on the other side of the fence.
Right.
But there must have been limitations there. Either the big three said, watch this guy, or just give him enough to get him started, and he'll go away.
Mm.
This has happened before. Now, the other, believe it or not, 14 cars, see, Phil was there then.
Yes.
Had left.
Oh, you left at this point. Now,
we had the car complete. They were completed by volunteers.
You mean when the, as you say, when the
CC, Securities Exchange Commission, right?
You guys were without.
Well, we already did the car.
Yeah, okay.
We were complete.
Well, of course, this is a consultant.
Yeah, we finished, yeah, and we went on back.
Back to Lippincott.
But Phil, the nice part about the book is Phil stayed on.
Oh.
For nearly another 10 months.
Wonderful.
And finally Alex looked at him, and it's all in here.
Mm-hmm.
And Alex said, you know, there's nothing left. We better, Phil, let's get out.
Bail out.
And that's why they know who finished the other 14 cars.
Now, in the 10 months between the time you left, do you remember seeing 34 cars for the time
you left?
No. Oh, no.
When I left, I can remember. We were so happy that we got a final from
mm-hmm.
Preston. This is what it was going to be. And then, of course, the boys were trying to source, even though they didn't have a finished drawing,
right,
a tool drawing. You had to have a tool drawing.
I see. So from the time you left until the time the final debacle,
SEC,
was 10 months. And during that time, the 51 cars were made, or the
37 cars.
Yeah.
And
period. Now that is covered mostly by Phil.
This is all Phil, because Phil was with them from just about day one with Lippincott.
Uh-huh.
And that's the reason he knows the Alex Tremulous side so well. They became buddies.
Yeah.
And this is why Automotive Quarterly has asked him, Phil,
sure,
to write the Tremulous
story.
Biog.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, he is doing now a condensed version of the book for Automotive Quarterly. It'll appear first. Then they're trying right now to get I think in the book world they got to have distributors or some way of getting the book out. This being not a novel, very little sex in it. They just talk about the men's room, that's about it. So we got to have something.
Well, let's hope it goes.
Yep.
But one last question, if I may, about this particular, your aspect of the Tucker situation. As the car evolved to the final version, how much of it is Lawson? How much of it is Tremulous? How much is it of Lippincott? Could you venture a
The only thing I can say, in looking at both the cars, looking at the front end, the car that you looked at last night there in the at the Hyatt Regency,
the SAE meeting, right?
SAE meeting, that front end is 90% Lippincott.
Mm-hmm. Or which translate you.
Right, it has
say the Tucker Maverick and team.
That's correct, yeah. And team. It has the steer horn front end.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's got the six port exhaust and the back grid exhaust,
mm-hmm.
where Alex had the flat bumper, which was cheap, and he had the classic grill, which was competition had pre-war.
Classic what?
Well, I mean, competition had the same type.
What was it again? Classic what?
Well, I'm talking about classic, the competition.
Oh, I see.
The Studebaker had, of course, a horizontal bumper with a grill above it.
Okay, yeah.
And we put it all down below.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
Yeah. Of course, that car was liquid cooled. That delayed things. They had to go back to
why
Syracuse.
Why did they make that decision to go to liquid cooling?
She ran HOT.
Ooh, okay, okay. Right.
Couldn't do it.
Couldn't do it, huh?
Couldn't do it. Uh-huh. And they finally went out. They got 26, I believe the book is there, they got 26 nearly new or rebuilt axles,
mm-hmm.
front cord, transmission and axles, which they used on the Tucker. And the four-speed pre-electric select electric gearbox.
Uh-huh.
And they put the engine behind the centerline of the rear axle.
Uh-huh.
But that's all covered in the book. And the...
the book, of course, will not figure in what we're doing today, but basically, proportionally, how would you gauge it?
We gotta give Alex credit for the basic package.
Now you mean the engineering package?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because he had started it, and some of his nuances are obviously still there.
Okay, you're talking about chassis and body.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chassis and body.
Yeah, okay.
Now, as to refinements in the front end and the rear end, I think that we've come up with those concepts.
The Lippincott group.
Absolutely, okay. Are definitely there, and you will see it. As the book unfolds.
How about the swiveling Cyclops headlight? The term of the wheels. Whose idea was that?
That was Preston from day one.
Good.
He wanted that from day one, although there were many states that wouldn't permit it.
Why not? Oh, they needed to...
Well, because you had three headlights, and there are... Well, I can remember even right here at Ford, the headlight had to be a minimum of 28 inches off the ground, and this was not. And then the big problem was, if one of your headlights went out, you wouldn't know what the hell that was coming down the street. A little kiddie car, because you'd have, all right? And, but it was something that he wanted identity. He wanted that identity, no doubt about it. Because his laundry list was fantastic. If we could have, or if engineering could have, and if purchasing could have sourced that car and put it together, oh, you would have had a line 2 miles long waiting for one. But it never happened.
Never happened.
Never happened.
Mr. Tucker, based on your observation while you were with the, while you were consulting the Tucker organization, and based on what you've learned since, which I'm sure is considerable, it was a combination, was it not, of Tucker's visionary image plus the fact that he was perilously close to misrepresenting what he was going to produce and sell. And so was it vindictiveness that Homer Ferguson and Wilson Wyatt and others, or do you think they were genuinely concerned about the consuming public, or do you think they were the General Motors? And now Homer Ferguson was called the senator from General Motors at that time.
That's correct.
And it was well known that he owed his primary allegiance to them. So what do you think, how do you think this all came about, this terrible tragedy of this man being hounded into the courts and came out tarnished and penniless, really? How did it all happen?
We've chatted about that. Both Phil and I have chatted about it because I'm a little disturbed about the last paragraph in the book about the climax of this man's career, but we'll wait for the book to come out too. I don't know whether it was impatience on his part. He was a very impatient man and felt that the big three had honestly not cheated, but withheld, even in the pre-war days, the advancements of automotive technology.
Uh-huh.
And that was the reason he leaned on Harry Miller, front-wheel drive, very avant-garde in engine development and front-wheel drive and suspension, et cetera, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
Now, was it a dream that he could take the Miller philosophies and convert them into a realistic four-wheel, four-door automobile
mm-hmm.
overnight?
Yeah.
And he didn't think it was a challenge at all.
Hmm.
And I never forget Gordon related to the fact that when he discussed, he said, "Look, I know what I want,
mm-hmm.
and all you got to do is to translate this from paper,
right.
3D, into sheet metal,
mm-hmm.
and go on back to New York City." Smiling just like you, he had a very fine personality, and he was well dressed, had quite a family. As a matter of fact, we got involved with the family because the younger son at about 16 was going to a prep school in Wake Forest,
mm-hmm.
would come out, drive all the way down on Saturdays with his classmates and run a critique on the development of the car.
Mm-hmm.
"Why are you putting the air intake there for? Why don't you put it up in the back end?" You know, that's all we needed was another member of the family telling us what to do.
Uh-huh.
But getting back to your point, it's obvious the big three could squeeze. They had sourced galore. They had spent millions.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to tap into the same devices. If he wanted to go big, now, I'm thinking right now, whether it was monocoque, whether it had a chassis, because that one had a chassis. It was a modified chassis.
Mm-hmm.
Because we used a lot of Oldsmobile parts. We used a lot of Zephyr parts in it to get them. Because to go into a chassis development program, you've got to have X amount of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with Briggs or Murray,
yeah.
To do it. The assumption is we had the money.
The $22 million that was advanced.
That's correct.
From future stockholders and franchisers.
That's correct. And plus the fact he was into Central America, he was into Mexico, into South America. Because I can remember the interpreters that we had. I can hear them moving through, and they would stand aside of our clay models. Hey, you talk about a circus. And there they were continually. Oh yeah, there's some, and it went on.
Is it fair to compare him to John DeLorean? I don't think so. Do you? There's a super.
They both had a dream.
A superficial resemblance, but
yeah.
I don't think Preston Tucker was a crook. I think John DeLorean was. But that's my personal opinion. What do you think?
Let me say it this way. The man tended to be an operator, which he was.
Yes.
I think possibly the whole thing could have been fictitious. It could have been one of the last
uh-huh.
contacts he made, and he felt, you see, the climax here of 50 units with 50 pieces of tools left to, you know?
There's nothing in advance.
Nothing.
Which makes you a little suspicious in retrospect.
Correct.
Yeah.
But quite a story. And I see the reason that we're really talking today is that the four of us and Gordon, we lived for 40 years in total absence, totally anonymous, and we've never said, beyond my wife, Patricia, I never told the world. But it's like you say, remember the Tucker car? And 10 out of 10 will say, "What are you talking about, Tuck? What Tucker car?" There you go.
The forthcoming book by...
Phil Egan.
Phil Egan will, of course, remedy this omission.
Correct.
And what we've said today, I think, will help also in automotive design history. Right. You've been remarkably reticent all these years, modest about your part in it. What?
I had my accolades. I've had a wonderful life with Raymond Loewy,
uh-huh.
and there again, I could sign Loewy's name today. We all had that authority. Nobody ever signed a TPM or Bob Burke, and it was the same thing with Lippincott, and he received his money, And we went on about doing other things because the growth potential then was tremendous. I mean, you just dropped Tucker and you went into another arena just as quick as you could. And
well, I guess his epitaph would be that, as you said earlier, he had a dream. Mm-hmm. And while it may have been flawed, it certainly was not a, he was certainly not a charlatan.
Nope.
And he certainly was not a thief. He was actually a visionary who perhaps reached too far.
That's it. And too quick?
And too quickly. Yep. Yeah. I'd like to spend the remaining time, if we may, Mr. Manwick, in your incredible career with Raymond Loy. Could we spend about 45, a good solid half hour, talking about your experiences with Raymond Loy and the building of that mystique and that image, and of course the products that emanated from your association with him. Period of the 50s, I think, was pretty much the decade of the 50s, wasn't it?
That is correct. Yeah. Dave, let's move into a timetable. I believe it was fall of 47. We had completed the Tucker car, and I was looking for new employment and went back again to the Raymond Loy Associates and knocked on their door, and I found a good reception. But Mr. Loy then reminded me once more that if I would negotiate for this London job, the position was offshore, was to reopen the London office that Carl Otto, one of the pioneer associates, had run prior to.
What's his name?
OTTO, Carl Otto. Uh-huh. By the way, ex Duesenberg too, Charlevoix, Michigan, great man. Uh-huh. But that was the opportunity. The opportunity here was to back to England post war, obtain the property, the building, and new accounts, and do what you could. 3-year stint, no woman involved, work hard, do your job, and you may become an associate. Very good. And they were going to open up Pandora's box. They were going to tell me what happened pre-war, what they were doing post-war, and I moved in with a month in New York City, in the business end of the business, and looked at the Pennsylvania Railroad schedule, the Frigidaire, Greyhound bus that we were doing then, and I looked at the accounts receivable, I looked at salaries, I looked at everything. I will say this much, they were extremely fair with me. And it looked from that moment on, once I got a look at the financial bit, I figured, well, Tucker looks good, and I think you're gonna be the guy to go. But Mr. Loy still has South Bend. He said, you must go out, I have a Bob Burke who is doing magnificent things. You must go out there and see the new Studebaker. I said, I'll go. I'll go, yes, sir. And
now, you had a, this was, in, what was this particular incident? What year was this?
This had to be 47, right after the Tucker account.
Oh, okay, fine.
Okay.
I mean, you
see, because I left Loy, then I went back. Then I went with Otto, then I went back with Loy.
I understand, but he wants you to go out and see the new Studebaker, the 47 Studebaker.
42nd,
right.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
And to spend time out there with Bob Burke and go through the engineering drawings, complete authority, take it all the way backwards, what they were doing, their suppliers, okay, the philosophy behind the design, et cetera, and the new stuff that would be unfolding in the 50s, et cetera, and okay. I didn't even know Bob Burke, so in those days you would get on the 20th Century, right smack there in New York City. That was, of course, Henry Dreyfuss's great contribution.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Dreyfuss had the New York Central account. Loy had Pennsylvania Railroad.
Right. But they both came to Detroit, did they not?
No, they did not.
Oh, they did not. Okay.
No, we're going into South Bend now.
Oh, of course.
Going in the South. You're right about Detroit. Going in the South Bend.
Okay, yeah.
And, of course, that train left New York City at 6 o'clock sharp, and it was the most magnificent run. You had a barbershop. You had telephone, you had compartments.
Was this the Chicago run?
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Which got us into Elkhart at the crack of dawn and then Seuss Bend, South Bend at about about 7:45, and Bob met me at the station, a little sleepy South Bend in a new post-war studio.
Couldn't
believe it. Wow. I'm sitting in this thing.
Wow.
I get all the room in the world from my knees.
They were gorgeous.
Oh, the windshield was away from me. We sat between the wheels. It was low.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't see the front end of the car. The hood sloped then, and I was in a different world. And
uh-huh.
I said, wowee, wow, this is totally unbelievable.
Uh-huh.
And Bob great guy, as Irish as can be. Who am I? I said, Bob, absolute intrusion. I said, I'm here on a orientation bit, a training program. I said, we'll spend a month or two together. I'm supposed to gather all the facts. Inside Burke, inside Studebaker, inside Exner, everything. And I'm going to leave you, going back to New York City, and then on to England. Oh, fine. So I guess he figured I wasn't going to get in his hair. I wasn't out there to become a new Burke or anything else. I was going to come in and learn the trade, and away we go. Well, as I walked into the office that day, Patty had just been hired, my wife.
Really?
And she was...
You had separated from your first...
That's correct. Prior to the Tucker bit, I single during that. We right after the Convair bit in 45, that all went away a bit. Anyway, look at this pretty girl. And I asked Bob immediately. I said, Bob, she free? Anyway, that's in Bob Burke's book. I forget what page it's on. And he said, gosh, she's only been here about a month or so. And she's doing publicity and whatnot. She's graduated from IU, worked for INS in Washington, D.C. And I said, fine. And boy, the second day I was there, how about lunch? And I imagine I may have been a bit rude there with Bob, I mean. But I was polite. At least we got back at 1 o'clock or whatever. And that was the end of that story. But Bob had a team then. And here was my first opportunity to view an outside consultant with the inside bit, because Exner then, they had separated, and Exner had beautiful studios within the Studebaker plant. We occupied the second floor of Sherman, Schaus, and Freeman, who are the largest Studebaker dealers in South Bend. Second floor.
Sherman?
Schaus and Freeman.
Schaus.
S-C-H-A-U-S.
Right. Okay.
Sherman, Schaus, and Freeman. As Teutonic as Herman Ringling. Not air-conditioned. You'd walk up, it was a factory atmosphere, the windows open, typical factory style, and here was the Burke studio. It was white on white, it was magnificent. You go down below was the garage and the sales room, and horns blowing and engines coming out, we went upstairs. I could see this bit of outside, you'll stay outside. You're the consultant? Okay. Gonna make it tough for you. They tried to make it tough for Bob. We had to wheel, believe it or not, the full-size clay bucks on through the streets over to the showroom, covered with canvas, praying that we wouldn't get a fracture in the clay through the bucks. This is how primitive it was then, and this is the way of life. And
how far away were you?
Oh, how would you like, a block and a half, 2 blocks? This wasn't across the street.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it at night. And that was the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Bob and Lori were outside, but who had the contact with the management? Of course, it was Louis. Louis was very, very close, and he had all of these successes running for him. The Pennsylvania Railroad, the Frigidaire, the Coca-Cola, I mean, all you'd have to do was to call somebody, and there was the evidence. Yes, did sales increase? Yes, sales did increase. How? By a change in contour, change in color, change in graphics, et cetera, et cetera.
But actually, it was still staying on somehow. He had somebody's here somewhere.
The engineer.
Roy Cole?
And Roy Cole, he was absolutely one-to-one with Cole.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There was the confidence level for him. And Bob, of course, had this job of seeking. Again, you've got to have engineering clearances.
Oh, God, yeah.
You work with Adam, Tom Fuller, you're going right down the wrong road.
Sure.
I mean, but they were great days. Now, who was there? Well, they just had a layoff. This is ironical. I came in after quite a layoff. These were, can't think of right now, but I know that Bob will cover it in his interview. And here was I, of course, now I was on my way to London, so I really wasn't intruding.
Mm-hmm.
But we had John Cuccia was on board. We had Ted Brennan, we had Vince Gardner, we had Bob Cotto. We had a good mainstream.
Dick Khalil?
Dick Khalil, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. John Byrd?
John, well, now he was a modeler.
Yeah, right.
John was a modeler. I'm talking about purely the creative staff.
Yeah.
Must have been about five or six of us then.
Mm-hmm.
And then Goodcliffe, we had Johnny Lutz, whose father,
yes,
of course, was the head Plastiman, not Plasti, but clay at General Motors.
Right.
Day one.
Yes.
And John could move it, Johnny Bird could move. We had real talent.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a fine shop, fine model shop.
Of course, Cotto was two-fisted, but he could design
yes.
and model.
And model, and quickly.
Yeah.
He was very, very fast. Mm-hmm. Bob did a super job. But you put all that talent together. Bob had more than one buck going, and I'm quite sure you looked at the photographs, so Bob will pass them on to you.
Yeah.
He always had a choice, and so did Lowy, of alternate back ends, alternate front ends, alternate side profiles, rear quarter,
mm-hmm.
interiors,
right.
and it was just a great atmosphere, challenging,
mm-hmm.
just super,
Gee,
super indeed. Lowy came in about once a month, so Bonnie would come in twice a month. Some of the stories with Bonnie and with Lowy were unbelievable in the time.
Uh-huh.
Bonnie, of course, was rather astute. Bonnie had all transportation. Bonnie had Pennsylvania Railroad. He had Studebaker. What else did we have on wheels then? Greyhound.
Mm-hmm.
Bonnie loved to sit on the high stool and gaze at some of these shells that were there in their obvious clay.
Mm-hmm.
And this one day he said to Bob, Bob, we got to lower that roof line, quarter inch, 3/8 inch. You've got to do something. He said, I've been sitting here. It's bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked and talked and talked. They said, look, I'll be back in 2 weeks. Do me a favor. I know, changing a contour like that.
Mm-hmm.
Bob says, no problem, Bonnie. See you in 2 weeks. Bonnie came back, of course, in 2 weeks, and we hadn't touched it at all. Bob says, what do you think of it? God damn it, he said. Boy, it's an improvement.
This is Bonnie Roos?
No, this was Bonnie Barnhart, senior partner.
Oh.
See, it's Raymond Lowy Associates.
Of course, yes.
We had Barnhart, and we had Otto, and we had Bill Snaith, who did all the interiors for Lord and Taylor.
Oh, okay.
Very profitable, doing space environment, which is what Wally does, interiors.
Right. Wally Ford, yeah.
Yeah, Wally Ford, but never changed it. During a presentation, we always had a series of hood ornaments
mm-hmm.
set up.
Yeah.
And normally you would sit down with Mr. Lowy, and he would fondle them and pick out his favorite, but this time we were running late. He picked up this one hood ornament, honestly, picked it up backwards, placed it on the center line of the hood in a reverse position, and sold it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Mr. Vance, the accolades came out. Oh, that'll do something to the car. Boy, isn't that great? Nobody said a word. He put it on totally in reverse, which none of us had thought about, and it worked.
It worked, huh?
It worked.
But was his position inadvertent or an aesthetic decision on his part?
We hadn't rehearsed it with him.
So it was inadvertent.
Absolutely.
But it worked.
It worked.
That's marvelous.
Nobody said a word, and there were so many items, of course.
Did that come out that way?
It sure did.
Which model?
It was the Commander 1950.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
That's marvelous.
Yeah. Well, it was a series. It was a sculptured collar with a fin going through it, and it made no difference whether the nobody said a word. But we did many, many things for
the first phallic symbol, I think.
One of them.
Go ahead.
It wasn't often, but more than once or twice a week.
Uh-huh.
Lowy would come in and would say, get us together. He said, we have a problem in Dayton with Frigidaire. I would like to have you spend at least today, maybe tomorrow, maybe the next day. And I want doors. I want handles and doors. And I want interiors. And boy, we would sit down and we would, this is on Studebaker billable time, I want you to know.
Uh-huh.
It's a no-no.
Right.
But we would help sister divisions out and sister product lines, and it was fun. It was really, really fun. And it was always, you were always gratified when you did something like that. You would do it. And of course, working for Bob, Bob was a piece of cake as a boss.
Is he?
Oh, he was just so generous.
Such a nice man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you funny, because you've got to have these anecdotes.
Please.
But the second floor of Sherman's house, Freeman, it was not air conditioned. It got hot in Indiana in the summertime in July. And had a big thermometer there. And one of the boys got the brilliant idea, taking a Zippo lighter, holding it about a foot below. Just tickling that enough, and we'd call Bob over. We had all the windows open, no screens, and hey, look, Bob, it's rough. And the problem with the clay the clay would get soft.
Very soft.
Very, very soft, and you could never get a beautiful finish on it. But didn't take him long. We got away with it once or twice.
Then he realized
he realized that we were massaging the bulb there. And then, of course, Exner went away, and Louis convinced management that we had to get out of that pathetic studio. And they had built a new facility for truck production during the war up at Cherokee Street or Cherokee Boulevard on the south side, which was just unique for a design studio. And we moved in there. We were thoroughly air-conditioned. We had our bucks. We had our clay ovens. It was just a magnificent transition from Sherman Chouse and Freeman. This is where I think Bob put together some of those great, great machines, the 50, which we were all. Now there was one where Louis emphasized and insisted on putting that spinner in, getting back to the quality of design.
Right.
We had the successful Chevy of that year, very successful, sitting alongside of it. The Chevy was massive compared to this petite.
Yeah.
Louis wouldn't bend. He would not bend. And of course, it became a laughing stock because the post-war, that little Commander and the 47, 48, even the 49, they were cute looking. Boy, they were good looking cars. Now, of course, we had the La Sabre coming out of General Motors. You remember that Harley Earl driving this. Well, I mean, the 50 was a little close to it in concept, you know.
Which?
Well, with this pencil sharpener with the front end, with the circular spinner front end, you know. But those, we felt, were not our finer years with the Lowy outfit.
One quick question. Did you ever get into the business about the 49 Ford? Did you remember anything about
it? I remember the conversation about it, but I was in England then. But I will tell you, it's a true story. And that's one hell of a story.
I'd like to spend the rest of our time today on your second go-around in New York and Chicago offices. We'll skip that for the moment. Let's get us back to 51 through 54. Let's see if we can cover that.
Where are we now? Let me have the paper.
Yeah, we're 51, 54. You're back in London, and you're back in the New York, Chicago office, and one of your accounts. You're supervising one of Raymond's accounts, which
That's
is,
correct.
Of course, Studebaker. Can you tell us a bit about the days at Studebaker from 51 to 54? That would be of great interest, I think. And again, working with Bob Burke, and by this time other people have come on the scene. Is there a thread of a story there?
Well, there is, because when we came back from England and got a look at the 53 concepts that were growing, this to me,
blew your mind. Yeah.
Heart started to beat everything because that GM philosophy of fins, stabilizers, and front ends with spinners on them was gone.
Right.
It was gone. This was a revelation.
Right.
And having just spent my time in Europe, where we looked at all of the stuff coming out of Italy, it was close sculptured. There was no fat on anything coming out of Italy.
Right.
You had a wheel well opening, and you had just a minimum amount of material, whether it's a Maserati or the Ciata or the Ferrari. They were really identifying the look of tomorrow. And they were light looking. They were sculptured right over the anatomy. There was no fat. They were beautifully done. And what Bob had going there was a translation of this. But here again, engineering, and Bob will speak with this with authority, all the no-nos. Well, what are we going to do with the radiator cap? The radiator cap's got to be on the top. It doesn't have to. It's been there for 70 years. Water seeks its own level. You can put it on the side. The radiator doesn't have to be vertical. It can be horizontal. World War II, we proved it.
Mm-hmm.
And all the tanks, they had the big horizontal. What do you know about cooling, Tuck? Bob, what do you know about cooling? Nothing. You telling me what to do? NIH, not invented here, started to grow. There was the silhouette. That's what we want. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get it.
Right.
Carburation. That confounded air intake and cleaner always sitting on the top.
Right.
You realize if you wipe that off, what you can do with the firewall, you lower everything down. Bob was the fighter. General Motors hadn't reached that yet. Do you realize that? GM hadn't. And here is Burke. Now, I will say this much for Robert. Bob was the champion with engineering. He may not tell you this, I'll tell you right now. He was the champion with engineering, with Harding and the boys. He was the one who rolled up the sleeves. We didn't. We were a little disturbed about it, but here again, I guess one voice is better than four or five of us taking buckshot.
Mm-hmm.
But Bob would spend the evenings. That's where they would have their sessions. We were free of this. And then you would see the following day, we always got clearances from engineering, got engineering drawing, clearance drawing. Bob would say, hey, you nearly got it. We're not down there yet. Looking good.
Mm-hmm.
Looking good. These are the challenges that we had. And the other thing we had as an irritant was the coach joint. Coach joint is when you have two flanges that come down like that and you weld them and you have an opening going all the way through. We could see the Union coming up with a strong fight. They were deprived of the matching salary they were getting in Detroit. In Detroit, they were using lead, General Motors. They were wiping lead on the rear quarter and getting rid of these open joints. We found out that we couldn't afford it, and we went with these pathetic open joints. That's why some of those studios, I tell you, they were rust factories. That's what we made. They really went away. But here again, you had the Union dictating to management, dictating to the cost of the car, which affected the overview of styling in that sequence. It hurt. It really hurt. Had to do it.
Mm.
Yeah, had to do it. Same with the engine. We had that pathetic L head that went back to 1926. I was remember the big six that was known as, and sure enough, they finally got the news that they could not compete. They had the most exciting Starlight Coupe there and the new post-war silhouette, but you had a 1923 L-head primitive engine. My father, bless him, knowing that his son worked at Studebaker, bought a post-war champion with automatic transmission, with all of these accessories, and this poor engine couldn't even keep the windshield wipers going, you know. But such is life. They had to. That's when we noticed the rocket engines coming in from Oldsmobile, and automotive really took the Oldsmobile Rocket 88 engine as the concept that became the new Studio V8. Very, very close. But why not copy from the best? And what's another V8?
In the short time that we have left today, Mr. Manor, could you sum up Raymond Loewy, his mystique, his accomplishments, his methods, his good and bad sides?
I've got to say the side was good, basically, Dave. The alumni that he created in the design world will go on and on and on. The flavor of design, the sincerity of design, came from his basic philosophy, what he wanted. Things had to be right. There were very, very little compromises that he would make in the world of graphics, in the realm of sheet metal, transportation, comfort, accessibility, getting in and out, weight. I'm not saying he set the criteria, but he followed and would run a critique. Is that the best you can do, Bob? Bob, do you think this? Bob, I would like to do this. He was always there with a running critique, trying to get the best in sound and comfort and texture.
Mm-hmm.
Love the use of gold. Love the use of white on white.
Mm-hmm.
These were Loewy touches that have really lived. He had no respect for Holly Earl, had no respect for all of the super jet stuff, the big fins,
mm-hmm.
was anti-fin, and I think we all accepted that wipe them off, make the car look like a car, because this thing couldn't go any faster than the basic automobile in feeling that followed form following function.
Yeah.
They were embellishments, like taking a good-looking broad and putting on all the little ding-dangs and the lipstick and the paint and the earrings. You can go on and on and on.
Right.
Embellishments that you paid for as a consumer, that you had to pay gasoline to drive around, and these all handicap performance, mm-hmm. longevity of the car, yeah. etc. So Lowy did set the tone, I will say that much, the design tone, mm-hmm. and just about everything with it was United Airlines on the DC-6s. He was there, monitoring and
editing,
very good,
yeah.
editing and...
But hiring the best people you could find.
No problem with money, no problem, well, let me give you a couple of examples. We brought over some talent from the continent, Jakob Jensen, we brought him over, and he couldn't even speak English. Mm-hmm. He was from Finland.
Mm-hmm.
No, that was Tapio Virkola, who came out of Finland. And for Lowy to get him over, he was an excellent designer of glass. Of course, we had the Brown-Forman account. You remember the booze decanters years ago?
Sure.
You would get these decanters at Christmas time. Mm-hmm. Well, he hired Tapio Virkola, and I became... Virkola, W-I-R-K, work, A-L-A. He was Finnish.
Tapio.
Not a word of English, but Lowy heard of him over there. Brought him over and brought his wife over too, and she was spokesman for him. And he loved his schnapps, like they all do over there. And Lowy says, hey, I don't care if you you want to have that at noontime. And he would get in at 10 and work from 10 to 10.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Yeah.
Oh, we had hours like that.
Wonderful.
It was great. You had to produce, and we had deadlines galore.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we traveled around the world, always first class. Always stayed at the Ritz in London, mm-hmm. the Ritz in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Just a great guy. And I think a lot of it is really dusted off, I would say, on the clan.
Mm-hmm.
And I can name a host of them that are successful today or have been.
Mm-hmm.
Just based on that Lowy touch.
The Lowy alumni are legion.
Oh, they are.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All really marvelously talented and successful people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You obviously benefited from that association. You found it one of the great experiences of your life. The Lowy experience. Were there any negative signs?
Credits.
He tended to take credit for almost everything.
One of the great irritants was the Great Design Society, American Society of Industrial Designers, ASID,
mm-hmm.
which is formed, believe it or not, as a club comprised of Lowy Teague, Dreyfus, Bell Geddes, Donald Deske, never the Detroit group at all. Harley Rowe would have nothing to do with it. He was corporate. These were all consultants.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They were concerned about a tax issue in the state of New York where they were trying to move themselves out of the tax bracket like a corporation and into one of the professionals.
Mm-hmm.
And they formed this club. It never did work, but it was the only voice really that a designer had. You had SAE, you had AMA, you had the architects, who were they now? American Institute of AIR.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we had nothing. We could see it as a growing profession. That's when we formed little IDI, the Industrial Designers Institute, and finally,
Brooke Stevens was one of that group, too.
That's correct. But finally, we got a hold of Henry Dreyfus and Matowick, both of us. If you look at the old poop sheet in the IDSA, you will see there where we finally started talking together. We formed committees, and we said, enough of this nonsense, and we shook hands, and we put it together.
Wonderful.
And we now have one design group with about 2,000 members, 3,000.
It's
big, which is IDSA, Industrial Designer Society of America.
Yeah.
And I'm a fellow of both of the three of them. But
Lowy, in spite of that, he kept most of the credits for himself.
That's correct. Yeah.
Was that a character flaw, do you think?
It's tough.
Yeah.
But let me tell you how generous the man was. Another anecdote here. Vince Gardner, I always admired Vince.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've heard of him too, but we would, Bob would do a Lowy car a year. We would take a Studebaker and embellish it.
Right.
And give it the Lowy touch, a one-of-a-kind, one-off, or though we'd buy a chassis, a Jaguar chassis, or anything out of the continent, ship it to Bob, and we would have it done. That car had to be brought to New York City, so Vince and I, this one time, brought the car to New York City. Arriving at the Waldorf, where Lois shared an apartment, he lived at the Waldorf, and you've heard of the Waldorf Towers.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Raymond's neighbors were the Duke and Duchess of Windsor,
of course,
and Warner, of Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So Vince and I arrived in this splendid Jaguar, parked it down below, went up.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Lowy in turn said, "What are you doing that weekend?" We said, "Very little." He said, "Well, here are the keys of the apartment, and I want you to come out to Port Washington tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have lunch, and spend a nice weekend with me." And this was just super, super indeed. But that evening, the front door rang. Lo and behold, gentleman at the door, husky, said, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm Tucker Matowick, and this is Vince Gardner. We work for Raymond Lowy." He said, "My name is Maximilian Lowy. I am Raymond's brother from Mexico City. What are you doing here?" We found out, Dave, that he had the General Motors franchise. He had Cadillac and Chevrolet in Mexico City and Frigidaire. So the other brother was a surgeon in New York City, younger brother of Raymond. So he had one brother, Max, running the franchise there in Mexico City. But the generosity was there. He gave us a car.
Generosity of spirit.
Oh, he